welcome to the 11th episode of the Historic Present podcast, hosted by myself, Charlie Gordon, and my good friend, Jonah Howe. Jonah.
Hello.
Hello.
So for today's podcast episode, we are joined by historian Andrew Chatterton, who specialises in a lesser known subject of the Second World War, I think it's fair to say, on which strategies Britain took to defend the island in case of any German invasion. So Andrew, hello.
Hello there.
So in today's episode, we're going to be talking about the auxiliary units of the Second World War. Now, this is a much less commonly heard side of World War II history. As GCSE students, we haven't touched on this at all in our GCSE course. So it's going to be really, really interesting to listen to you and to learn a bit more about a really fascinating subject. Andrew, do you want to introduce yourself to us and a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, my name's Andrew Chatterton. I work with a group of volunteer researchers at the Coleshill Auxiliary Research Team, which is acronymed CART. So we research and look into the auxiliary units and the special duties branch, which were both units made up of highly secret civilian volunteers who would have, in the event of a German invasion of Britain during the Second World War, acted as a kind of form of resistance during the initial stages of invasion. And you're right, you won't be learning about this at GCSE. And I guess that narrative of Britain and what everyone learns at school about the Second World War, of Britain in 1940, you learn about a bit of the Blitzkrieg, you learn about Dunkirk, you learn about Britain being alone, apart from a big navy and a massive empire, but alone in the sense of, you know, the rest of Europe being occupied or being the enemy. And there's that narrative that goes through that we were unorganized and weak and kind of just sitting and waiting for the inevitable invasion to happen. But the actual truth is that there are several layers of really highly secret defense that just shows us Britain in a very different way, in a ruthless, sabotage, guerrilla warfare, dirty warfare kind of way that just doesn't fit with the narrative that not only you guys are learning about at the moment, but all of us have kind of bought into over the years since 1940.
Andrew, I'm going to start off. What was the specific role of these auxiliary units?
So the auxiliary units were born out of a couple of areas, and that kind of defined their role. So initially, they were formed from a conversation, it seems, between Anthony Eden, who was Minister of War just after Dunkirk. He went to have a chat with Lieutenant General Andrew Thorne, who commanded 12 Corps, which was down in that kind of Kent, Sussex area. So the bit of Britain that's really prone to invasion. And they got talking. Thorne had been, during the 1930s, the military attaché in Berlin. And part of the irony of the auxiliary units, it appears that it was somewhat led there by German influence, because Thorne had got to learn about the German peasantry militia, which for hundreds and hundreds of years in Germany had basically hidden caches of weapons. And if a foreign invader came in, they would grab their weapons and try and take on the invading army from behind the lines. And Thorne thought, you know what, that could really work in Britain if an invading army came. We could arm civilians, they could go out and try to take the German army on at night. And so the idea got back to Churchill eventually. And obviously, this is such a Churchill idea. I mean, anything of like guerrilla warfare and sabotage, Churchill loved it. So Churchill kind of took up the task as well. And eventually they found a chap who works for a group called Military Intelligence Research called Peter Fleming. Now, Peter Fleming is the brother of Ian Fleming, the guy who wrote James Bond. And you'll kind of see where that comes into later. So Peter Fleming started like these prototype auxiliary units in Kent, and he'd like go and find farmers and farm workers and gamekeepers, anyone who knew their local area really, really well and could live off the land. And so he got them in, he trained them, he got his other brother, his Richard, who was in the Lovat Scouts Regiment. So that was like highly trained kind of guerrilla type forces. And they came and trained these farmers in Kent to become guerrillas and saboteurs. And they kind of taught them how to blow up stuff. They taught them how to kill silently. They taught them all the dirty tricks that generally the British Army were not fans of at this point. And so it became really quickly obvious that this could be a thing that could be extended the length of the country and could be really useful if the Germans invaded. So that was in place. At the same time, and coincidentally it seems, a guy called Lawrence Grand, who worked for SIS, which is MI6, was doing something similar. He worked for Section D within SIS, which had been formed in the 30s to work out ways of how to fight the enemy in different ways than the normal army, the British Army. And they tried to help like the Czechs and the Poles form resistance before the Germans started to invade, but they just got there too late. And by like 1940, obviously May, June 1940, it wasn't about helping other people, it was about helping ourselves. So Grand formed the Home Defence Scheme, which was essentially the same as what Fleming was doing. So arming civilians. Grand was a bit of a maverick. He was just giving basically anyone weapons and explosives, bunging explosives in bridges and stuff without telling anyone they were there, that kind of stuff. And so eventually, the stuff that Peter Fleming was doing in Kent and the stuff that Lawrence Grand were doing was kind of merged into one, and that's what the auxiliary units were. So their role would be, as the Germans kind of entered the area, a patrol made up of kind of 5 to 6 men would completely disappear. So they signed the Official Secrets Act. They would disappear, leave their family and friends. They wouldn't know where they've gone. They would disappear to their operational base, their secret underground base, which we can talk about later. Stay there, wait for the Germans sometimes literally to go over the top of them, and then come out at night and blow up ammo and fuel dumps, to blow up key bridges, to blow up convoys, to blow up airfields and aircraft on the airfields if the Luftwaffe had taken it. Destroy great big country houses that the Germans would take as headquarters. They would assassinate high-ranking German officials. They would assassinate British collaborators. So anything that helped hold up that German advance. So not like France, where the Blitzkrieg kind of just flew through. Anything that would hold them up a bit to give the regular army time to kind of regroup and then counterattack. That was their role. It wasn't about taking on the German army direct in like in a gun battle. This was dark at night, taking on sentries from behind and getting rid of them quickly and silently to get access to the thing they needed to blow up. So that was their role. And as I said, they also signed the Official Secrets Act. And as I was saying before, like 70% of them went to the grave without telling anyone, without, you know, their wives didn't have a clue. So yeah, a remarkable group of civilian volunteers.
Wow. Yeah, no, it sounds fascinating, in all honesty. And I just want to ask, so how much were people, you know, I guess maybe not just the auxiliary units, but the entire country, including Churchill and the cabinet and everyone important in Britain, how much were people convinced about a German invasion? Did it seem very likely that the German invasion was going to occur?
That's a really good question, because the answer is the normal person on the street was convinced that an invasion was imminent. So we've got testimony from auxiliary unit members who said the officers who came to recruit them said it's not if the Germans will arrive, it's when the Germans will arrive. And so, you know, your role is absolutely crucial. And the man on the street, they were convinced. And that was partly because of the propaganda that was being put out by the British government. So it was in the British government's interest to keep the thought of invasion high in the mind of the civilian.
Yeah, but you were talking about, obviously, the word on the street being that, you know, the German invasion was imminent. And I guess you're right. The British government obviously had to sort of engage that sort of fear factor with the civilians to make sure that they didn't get complacent, perhaps, and, yep, you know, make sure there was plenty of resistance and sort of, yeah, as you say, underground guerrilla warfare in preparation for a possible attack. So, yeah. I mean, what else is there to this? I mean, I'm really not an expert in this field, honestly.
So I think a really interesting part of what they did in their role are these secret bunkers that we're still discovering all over the country. So as I said, most of the auxiliaries went to the grave without saying anything to anyone, and so these secret bunkers that they would have gone to have just remained shut up, and the very nature means that they're often completely undiscovered until someone takes us there. And they're remarkable things, and you know, the levels of ingenuity are crazy. So like, to get into a bunker, there's a hatch which is completely flush to the floor, covered in debris so you can't see it. And to open it, you need to pull what looks like a tree root, and it comes up on like a counterweight thing, and it pops up and swivels around, or you drop a marble down what looks like a rabbit hole. So the guys in the bunker know that one of you are there, and they can lift it up, or you just stamp on it and it pops up. And you go down a ladder, like 6 foot or something, a long way down, and then you're confronted by a blast wall, just in case the Germans found you and dropped a grenade down, and then into the main chamber where you have like the bunks and the tables for sleeping during the day. Sometimes a kitchen to obviously cook your rations on, and obviously smoke isn't ideal if the Germans are searching for you. So they used to take the chimney and funnel it up a hollow tree, so the smoke would disperse at the top of the tree line, so the Germans couldn't spot them. And then at the end, there's like an escape tunnel. So if the Germans did find you, you could get out, and it would take you 5 or 6 meters away, and you've got a chance of getting away. So these were all over the country. So if you think from the kind of Orkneys, yeah, up in the north of Scotland, down the east coast of Scotland, northeast coast, east coast, southeast corner, south coast, and South Wales.
Okay.
There are about 4,500 men in the auxiliary units, and you know, the number of patrols is hundreds of patrols, and each one of them had at least one bunker, and we know, I don't know, half of where all these bunkers are. So there are loads still out there waiting to be explored. Quite a few got destroyed. There's a really good example of in Devon, of a bunker being a road being widened between Exeter and Plymouth up this massive hill, and the JCB was kind of digging out the all the debris, and this old bloke suddenly starts running up the hill. So better stop, don't dig anymore, because the JCB was about to dig through the roof of this, which of explosives, and this was like in the 1970s. So he managed to get up there just before there was a huge explosion and loads of people got killed.
Oh wow.
But there's lots of examples of them still all over the place. They're the most remarkable thing. So yeah, they would have disappeared there.
I mean, in your opinion, sort of, and according to the evidence, I suppose, how prepared were the auxiliary units for the attack?
Yeah, they were really, really highly prepared, because the level of training they got was really, really high.
Yeah.
So they had to go to a place called Coleshill House, which is near Swindon. And this kind of emphasizes the level of secrecy as well, that they were just given a letter saying you have to go to Highworth, which is the nearest town. And from there, you would have to go to the local post office to see the postmistress called Mabel Stranks, give a password. Mabel Stranks would then ring up Coleshill House, and then they'd send a truck around to pick you up once all your credentials have been checked, and then drive a convoluted route back to Coleshill. But once you were at Coleshill House, you got training in explosives, you got training in silent killing, you got training on kind of captured German tanks and planes, so you learned where to put the explosives to do the maximum damage. You got trained in kind of stalking at night, so walking silently, no one could hear you. You got trained in navigation at night. You got trained in, you know, that kind of SAS,
yeah,
commando style training. These were some of the first guys to get that level of training, and these were the auxiliary units. So in terms of being prepared for a German invasion and prepared to do what they needed to do, then they were really, really highly prepared. And equally to that, they would have been extremely ruthless. So anyone, so like innocent British civilians, anyone who accidentally stumbled across their secret underground bunker, anyone who was asking too many questions, anyone who accidentally saw them all on patrol would have been the first people the patrol would have killed when the Germans entered their area. Because what they couldn't do was allow the Germans to get wind of what was happening, of what the patrol were up to and where they were. They knew they had like 2 weeks maximum. That was their life expectancy. So in order to maximize the time to do the maximum damage to the enemy, they would be extraordinarily ruthless in getting rid of British civilians who, in all intents and purposes, were innocent. They'd also have to, you know, get rid of the local policemen who would have to have checked their background to allow them to join the auxiliary units. They would have to have, in all likelihood, got rid of the officer who initially recruited the patrol leader and the patrol, because he knew where all the patrols were in his particular county and who were in them. So even the officer who put them together would in all likelihood have been assassinated as soon as the Germans came in. So not only were they highly prepared for invasion, they were going to be really ruthless in their execution of that role. And that is something, you know, and that again goes against this kind of narrative and story that we have in our heads about Britain at this point of being kind of drinking tea and, yeah, you know, and waiting for the horrific Germans to come. In fact, we were prepared to be ridiculously ruthless. I mean, just kidding. There's an example in Cornwall of a patrol digging their underground bunker in a copse, and this elderly couple living in a cottage kind of overlooking the copse. And as they would dig in, the elderly couple would wave and say hello. The first people this patrol would have to kill as the Germans came into the area were the elderly couple.
Yeah.
Because if the Germans got hold of this elderly couple and said, "What's going on?" they could really easily just point to where this underground base was. If they're already dead, then they couldn't do that. And this patrol, you know, these guys aren't bloodthirsty. I mean, they're just ordinary civilians.
Yeah, I was going to ask, who actually are these people? How are they targeted? How are they selected by whoever to come and join?
Because it's a really good question. Trusted? So it's after the stuff Fleming was doing and the stuff Grand was doing was combined into the auxiliary units, a guy called Colonel Colin Gubbins came to lead the auxiliary units and to extend it the length of the country. He later went on to help set up SOE. So Gubbins recruited intelligence officers who had like an affiliation with some of the really key counties, so those coastal counties. And they'd go to each county and they'd find an area which would be a really good area for a patrol to be based. So somewhere near like an airfield or a big house or a key road or railway, something like that. They would then find a patrol leader or a potential patrol leader. So usually a farmer or a farm worker, or further up north, like a miner, something like that. Someone who really knew their local area intimately. It would be then up to the patrol leader to recruit the rest of his patrol.
Were there any incentives, or was it just?
Again, sorry.
Were there any incentives to joining, or was it? Did they not have a choice?
I think quite a few joined from the Home Guard. So their incentive was to do something more interesting than patrol around with fake rifles and to go to Sunday morning parade at the church. You know, this is, you know, quite often they would be approached and say, "Do you want to do something more exciting and dangerous?" And for, you know, blokes who are like 20, 30, 40, that, yes, you're probably going to take that chance. Yeah. But the patrol leader recruited, because of the nature of it, because of the secrecy, recruited his mates, friends, family, colleagues, people he could trust and were probably equally used to the area around them and could move around at night and know where they were, etc. So that's who they recruit. And it is farmers, farm workers, gamekeepers. We've got lots of examples of gamekeepers recruiting poachers because the gamekeepers knew that the poachers knew the land as well as them and could definitely live off the land. You know, and it's, again, testimony to the ruthlessness that they would have to show, that they were told, if you're out at night and you've destroyed a target, or you're destroying a target, and one of the patrol gets injured and you can't get him back to your underground base, you have to shoot that patrol member. Because you can't allow him to end up in the hands of the German army. And then if you think back, that the people you're recruiting are your friends and family and colleagues, you would then potentially have to, you know, we've got examples of fathers recruiting sons. If your son's injured, you can't get him back. Your responsibility as patrol leader is to execute him, or at least leave him with the weapons to take out German soldiers and to kill himself. Yeah. Which is crazy, isn't it? I mean,
it is crazy. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating because what I've seen for us, all we really hear about is the Home Guard, as you said, just patrolling around. Sort of, we hear that it'd been so easy for Germans to, you know, sail 30 miles and smash through and take Britain, right? But obviously, I never known about, you know, the auxiliary units and all that came with it, and the fact that it was something similar to sort of a French, Belgian, you know, resistance, an underground resistance built to sabotage, you know, the Germans. Obviously, thankfully, it didn't really come into use.
But
I just want to ask one final thing. I've just been looking at your website. Who were the special duties branch?
So the special duties branch was slightly different. So the auxiliary units were there to blow stuff up, essentially, and cause as much havoc as possible. The special duties branch were again civilians who were there to observe, essentially, to observe the German army going through their town or village and to make a note of the amount of men, the direction of travel, the type of vehicles they had, what regiment it was. So again, not like the Blitzkrieg, where the Germans kind of fled through and filed through and everyone else kind of fled in front of them. Civilians were to stay behind, wait in their village and keep an eye on it. They would then write down their message and the information. They'd leave it at dead letter drops. So we've got examples of like tree stumps where you could swivel around the top of the tree stump and put your message in there, or a gate which had a horseshoe on. If the horseshoe was facing up, there was no message. If it was facing down, there was a message, and the message was secreted in a fake gate bolt. So you'd pull the bolt out and the message was in there. And then there'd be a series of runners and messengers who'd take that message and it'd end up with a civilian wireless operator. So usually, again, so not like farmers who'd attract attention, but like vicars and doctors or elderly people, or, you know, people your age, people who could just walk around without attracting, you know, the wrath of the German army. And then that message was then sent via wireless to ATS girls who are in bunker, secret bunkers, rather like the ones the auxiliary units were in, who would then radio that on to the regular army in high command. So this gives the regular army the information of where the Germans are, which direction they're moving in, how many there are, and gives them the opportunity then to say, right, we've got this battalion here, we're going to send them here because we know the German army going in that direction. So it's the opposite of what happened in the Blitzkrieg. Uh-huh. And again, all these guys signed the Official Secrets Act or were sworn to secrecy. And we know even less about these guys than the auxiliary units, because, you know, most of them again went to the grave without saying anything. But their role was incredibly dangerous. Had the Germans invaded and these guys were caught taking notes of what regiment it was and how many guns they had and stuff like that, they would definitely have been executed. And they definitely knew that. So it's just another secret layer, which we don't know very much about, which a majority of the population in Britain knows nothing about, but kind of goes against that narrative of us not being prepared. We were massively prepared. You know, the French and Belgian and Dutch Polish resistance, by the very nature of the German invasions, could only be set up after Germans were an occupying force. We had the opportunity to set up a form of resistance before any invasion had taken place. Because of the channel, because of the confusion over Operation Sea Lion, we had that opportunity to prepare. And, you know, one of the first countries to be able to do that. So, but because of the secrecy, no one, hardly anyone in this country knows about it. And it goes against, you know, there's a certain pride I think we take in our in our vision of Britain in 1940, of standing alone, of old men with pitchforks, of, you know, drinking tea and stay calm and carry on, all that kind of stuff. But actually, underneath that surface, there was huge amounts of organization taking place the length of the country, like, as I say, from Scotland to Cornwall.
Yeah,
there were patrols of thousands of men, highly trained guerrilla and saboteurs, who were going to bite the tail of an invading force. You've got a spy network the length of the country, who were going to inform the regular army of the German direction. You've got wireless sets everywhere. You've got secret bunkers everywhere. So actually, we were really well prepared. And it, you know, what we do at CART is to try and raise the profile of this a little bit, because most of them went to the grave, they didn't get any public recognition. They got a tiny, tiny lapel badge.
Yeah.
And they got a letter saying, basically, thanks, guys, for your service. You're not going to get any public recognition. But they were stood down in November 44. And that's it. That's all they got.
With all this secrecy and with so many men taking it to the grave, when was the light shared on the public and people like you? Because if I take an example of the Enigma codebreakers of Bletchley Park, it wasn't until the 70s or 80s where the first news of what had happened came into the public eye. So how was the story like uncovered?
So initially, there was a book published in 1968 by a guy called David Lamp called Last Ditch. And he was the first guy to write about it. Most of the veterans were furious. And then we started getting access to some of the records in the National Archives about what was going on. Most of it wasn't written down because it's a highly secret organization.
Yeah.
So we got some access, and we were, you know, CART was set up in about 2010, something like that. So we're able to talk to some surviving veterans, but by you know, by the 2000s, most of them have gone already. So what we do now is we do stuff like this. We do podcasts and articles and things, and just try and get people's memories of what their grandfather might have told them, or their dad might have told them, or underground weird air raid shelters in the middle of forest that they might have played with in the 60s and 70s as kids, or, you know, if anyone's got one of these tiny lapel badges, or you know, we get stories over time of, we had a great story. We placed an article in the Western Morning News in Devon and Cornwall. And this guy was sitting around his table having Sunday lunch with his grandkids. And one of his grandkids said, look, it's an amazing story about secret guerrillas and underground bunkers and stuff. And his granddad went, yeah, I was in that. And this was like in 2011, something like that. And his wife, who he was married to during the war, was like, well, you weren't in that. You're in the Home Guard. What are you talking about? Don't make up stuff. You're being stupid. He went upstairs, got his lapel badge, got his commando knife, the main weapon that they had to kind of, which he'd hidden all these years. And that's a really good example of, one, how seriously they took their Official Secrets Act, but also why we don't know anything, hardly know anything about it, and why it's taken such a long time for people to become aware of it.
No, I think it's absolutely brilliant what you guys do, keeping the memory alive of these people who deserved, quite frankly, much more recognition than they did.
Yeah,
I think that's all we've got time for. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. You've been fantastic in educating us about this topic, and I hope everyone at home listening or watching enjoys it too. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Great.